Good morning, and today, as the new year begins, we start the celebrations of an impending 70th birthday. Woman's Hour was born on the 7th of October 1946, so it's quite a wait for the big party. But what prompted the plans to introduce a programme designed to meet the needs of busy listeners with a daily programme of music, advice and entertainment for the home? How come the first presenter was a man? Why have the criticisms been along the lines of laughably obsessed with domestic detail and dangerously radical, a feminist forum? And how, as the programme has lived through a gender quake, have the editors reflected the changes in women's lives and expectations? With us this morning throughout the programme are two former editors, Sally Feldman, 1990 to 1997, and Jill Burridge, 2002 to 2011. And two historians, Juliet Gardner and Kate Murphy. Kate was also a producer on the programme from the 1990s until 2011. Now, Alan Ivamy was the first presenter. He lasted all of 3 months and was replaced by Joan Griffiths. Norman Collins was controller of the Light programme in 1946, and he later explained to Marjorie Anderson what was behind his decision to commission Woman's Hour in the immediate post-war period.
I always visualised the poor, wretched housewife, her morale probably at the lowest, round about 2 o'clock in the afternoon when she had the washing up and lunch to do. And, of course, one of the great advantages of radio as against television is that you can do other things and listen at the same time. And I thought it would be a pleasant idea if we arranged for a programme, roughly an hour, in which there wouldn't be simply an endless succession of light music, but we would have speakers talking on those topics which would be of interest to intelligent women. And the whole thing I want to emphasise here is the intelligence of the woman, because I really do think that you will find a large number of programmes in which intelligence of the listener as a whole is underrated, and for some reason or other, particularly, the intelligence of the woman is underrated. So I thought we'd have a programme in which topics that are serious, topics of interest to women, and of course to men as well, would be broadcast and interspersed, shall we say, with a little light music, because this was not continuous listening. And then I thought it'd be rather nice if we had a reading from one of the popular works of fiction that have lasted over the years. So we made a start. And I remember for the first programme, we had a very fine mixed bag, because we had Margaret Bonfield, we had Deborah Carr, and we had Mrs. Elsie Crump, a butcher's wife. So that really was the beginning of Woman's Hour.
But I don't suppose you thought then how it would widen even more over the years, or did you?
Well, I did. Secretly, I always hoped that there would be more talk and less light music. And it's rather interesting, because when we launched the programme, I guessed it was going to be a success, because the listener felt it was very much his, or rather her, programme. So we knew that the listener was very much involved. But the great thing I wanted to do was to find a popular medium for talking about serious matters.
Well, now we have an all-round magazine programme.
And I can't be more pleased to hear that. And I'm also pleased that, you see, one of the things I wanted to do was to ensure that if you had a serious topic and the most intelligent speaker was a woman, you had a woman. If the most intelligent speaker on that subject happened to be a man, you have a man. Because it would have been completely unreal to say, this is a woman's hour, the speaker's got to be all women because women like listening to women, or all men because women like listening to men. So I am really, I'm grateful to think that the good work which I believe I started has gone on so successfully since, and I hope this is what the listeners enjoy.
Norman Collins talking to Marjorie Anderson, the presenter of My Youth, and that was 1967. No wonder I sounded so posh when I first started. Kate, what women's programmes preceded Woman's Hour? Because it wasn't quite as revolutionary as Norman Collins pretended, was it?
There was a huge array of programmes prior to 1946. In fact, there was actually a programme called Women's Hour in 1923 that lasted for about a year, until it was decided to get rid of the name, interestingly, and then the kind of talks became fewer. But they were resurrected again in the kind of late 20s, when they were called, firstly, Household Talks and then Morning Talks. Lots of different programmes, a huge array of programmes for women. And importantly, one of the producers was a woman called Janet Quigley in the 30s, who then went on to make some very significant programmes during the war, lots and lots of programmes during the war. And she came back in 1950 as one of the editors of Woman's Hour, and I think was quite important to the way that it kind of shifted at that period. So there was a lot of programmes, but it was different because it was an hour long and there was music, so it was a different feel, I think, to Women's Hour.
Julia, how important was radio for women in those years just after the war?
Oh, tremendously important. I mean, everyone had got into the habit, I think, of listening to the radio during the war, you know, catching news bulletins and things like that. And after the war, it was really an unmapped terrain. I mean, we were all told to face the future, which was the Labour Party's slogan, but nobody really knew what that slogan meant. Rationing continued, of course, for women right up to 1954. You know, shortages, all sorts of things that women had to cope with during the war, and it didn't seem to be very much better during the peace.
Kate, that first programme had Mother's Midday Meal and Putting Your Best Face yes. Forward. And I know sometime later there was advice on how to knit your own stair carpet, which I have to say I've never tried. How traditional was it throughout the 40s and 50s?
Well, there were those sorts of domestic items, of course, but no, it was very radical. So they were covering things like equal pay. There was a great celebration for the Nationality Act, the act that when you got married to a foreigner, you lost your nationality. So when that was passed in 1949, there was a huge celebration on the programme. They also were covering things like menopause and, you know, there was a whole antenatal clinic on the programme as well. They used the word vagina in 1947, amazingly.
But there was a very sniffy memo, wasn't there, about talks on the menopause, which happened in 1948,
yes.
And concern about the lowering of broadcasting standards.
Well, there was a very famous memo. This was a series they did on the change. It wasn't called the menopause until much later. And it was a big, an issue that wasn't discussed, and it was discussed on Woman's Hour. And then someone wrote to Norman Collins saying that they were acutely embarrassed to hear, and I think it was hot flashes, diseases of the ovaries, and the possibility of the removal of the womb at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, was seen as deeply shocking. But Woman's Hour did these things, and they always pushed, even though they were often doing things that were edgy, even in the 40s, right the way through. There were recording people, you know, there was a birth recorded in the 50s, all sorts of things that were very, very ahead of its time.
We know the government was very keen on a dedicated programme for women post-war, Juliet. Why a dedicated programme for women?
One of the reasons was that what role were women going to have in the post-war world? During the war, of course, women's lives had been turned upside down every bit as much as men's had. And after the war, what was going to happen? Were they going to go back to the home and hearth? Was the home and hearth going to be the same? Were they wanting to go out to work? Were they needed in the factories? Or were they not? Were the men coming back from the forces going to fill in this sort of thing? So I think the government thought they needed to have some sort of... the government was very big on instruction. They'd instructed people almost to death during the war, and they found it a hard thing to give up.
But how much was the government saying, yeah, we've sent all these women home, they're back in the kitchen now, tell them how to cook and make stair carpets? Or was there a real intention to give them information about, well, if you do want to go back to work, this is how you do it?
I'm not sure that it was a very detailed information, but yes, I think there was a real encouragement, because of course the government knew that industry needed labour. I mean, industry had been turned over to war production, it had to be turned back to peace production. A lot of women were needed in light industries and part-time work and all this sort of thing. So I think the government was all for, I mean, it was in the sort of cleft stick that it's always in, wanting women to be back at home and good mothers and good wives, but also knowing perfectly well that they were needed in the factories and industry and all, you know, manufacture, retail, all these things.
Kate, Norman Collins mentioned Elsie May Crump. What do we know of what she and other listeners made of the programme?
Well, they listened to that first programme, and then there was a response on the second programme from Deborah Carr, Margaret Bonfield, the cabinet minister, ex-cabinet minister, and Mrs. Elsie Crump, who came from Chawton-cum-Hardy in Manchester. Now, we don't know exactly what was said at that point, but when Joan Griffiths started in the beginning of 1947, Elsie Crump was invited back on, and we do know at that point that she said that she couldn't listen very often because she was often in the shop helping her husband, and that she was thrilled that they had last had a woman presenter, and she was talking about things like maybe there was too much music in the programme, but they did enjoy the items, you know, when she could listen. But already that kind of element of that's always gone through working women and women at home. It's always been a bit of a tension in the programme that you kind of you get from very early on, this idea whether you should be going back to doing part-time work or whether you should be at home.
Well, listeners or you, as I prefer to call you, have always had plenty to say about the programme. We used to read your letters and now the comments flood in much more quickly on email and Twitter. And the ones that always give us most pleasure are those that tell us the programme changed your life for the better.
Well, it was about 7 years ago. I was ironing and listened to Woman's Hour as usual, and there was a lady there telling of her experiences of having breast cancer. She was warning us that we should regularly feel for lumps and that the lump would only be the size of a pea. Well, I'm not one of these people that normally goes around looking for trouble, so I didn't take all of it in. That same evening, I got into bed and suddenly felt a twinge. Immediately I felt, and there was this tiny little lump. If it hadn't been for the programme, I don't think I would have even thought of it. The next morning I went to the doctor's, and within a fortnight I had my breast removed. Now here I am 7 years later, and I feel I owe my life to Woman's Hour.
I was listening to Woman's Hour about 3 years ago on the reorganisation of local government. And then a little later on, we had our RWI meeting on the same subject. And to our horror, we found that we had no candidate for the parish. So members persuaded me to take on the job, which I did. I was elected. I became a district councillor and a parish councillor. And I've had a very rewarding 3 years. And I'm now the chairman of the parish council. So thank you, Woman's Hour, for encouraging people like myself to do something positive.
I remember that it must have been over 20 years ago now that I heard an architect give a talk on Woman's Hour describing how he and his wife, and I think it was two little boys, built their own house. And this excited me so much that when my husband came home, I suggested that we might do the same thing. He was utterly contemptuous, and he said, "My dear, what on earth do we know about building?" It took me another 6 months to persuade him that we could learn. We then spent six exhausting and very often heartbreaking years building the house. Thank you, Woman's Hour.
And those voices were from 1976, and that's definitely one up from knitting your own stair carpet. How, Jill, did you picture the Woman's Hour listener?
Well, there were I had various categories of Woman's Hour listener, because you have the sort of bog standard profile, which is late 60s, my sort of age. And that was only a part of the story, really. 42% of the audience are men. So they're a considerable factor to take into account. And the other sectors I always thought about were those women who were taking time out for the first time to have their first baby. I say first baby because by the time you've had number two, you probably can't listen to the radio for the noise that the first one's making. But, you know, those women who are having their maternity leave were often tuning into Woman's Hour for the first time. And then the other category was students. You might not think of it, but at 10 o'clock in the morning, a lot of students are just getting out of bed, and so they switch the radio on, and there's Woman's Hour.
And Sally, how important were listeners' letters and emails to the way you structured the programme?
Not so much important. The structure wasn't so important, but knowing they were out there, knowing you were engaging with them, and knowing what an inclusive programme it was, I mean, interactivity became the sort of buzzword. Much, much later, we were always doing it. Right from the beginning, they were doing it, right from that very first programme. And I think the inclusivity of the programme probably accounts in great part to its longevity, because Woman's Hour never turned people away. It never had one line or another. It included everybody, and it proved it could, either by reading the letters or what you do now with Twitter and email. So I don't think it was the structure, but I do think it was the mood and the tone, and I think that hasn't changed that much. The accents have, of course.
Yes, but not so posh these days. So
no, I didn't recognise you. But the warmth and the feeling that you are a friend on that woman's side. And although Juliet was talking about the government wanting to inform women, what they had actually done after the war was close the nurseries. And there was we are the result of that. We are the baby boomers. And I've always thought that 2 o'clock slot, that sacred slot, was fantastically political, because the guru of the time was Truby King, who said, babies had to be fed regularly at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock and 6 o'clock. And there was the captive audience. And I'm sure that's why it was there at 2. And that is a great legacy, because we all must have injected it with our mother's milk.
Yeah, were you fed at 2 o'clock when your mum sat down and fed you? And Jill, I suspect you were too?
Well, my one of my earliest memories is being, after lunch, being made to sit down with my mother. She sat in this big leather armchair by the fire, and I would listen with mother, ding de dong, at quarter to 2, and then I was required to be quiet on her lap while she listened from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock to woman's hour.
Well, I certainly was listening to it whilst being breastfed by my mother. There were, Kate, always complaints from women who go out to work about the daytime slot. How open ever were the suits to a weekend or an evening repeat?
Actually, from very early on, this is something that was picked up on very, very early. So from 1948, you actually see them beginning to ask for this a programme that's not at 2 o'clock. And it starts off in 1951 with something called The Digest. And it's presented by Robert Dougal, who went on to be a newsreader. He presented this digest. But by 1953, it was called At Home for the Day. It moved between Sundays and Saturdays. And it was like a digest. But immediately there was this tension between, because of where it was placed, it was supposed to be for women who were going out to work. But where it was placed, it meant it was more for families as well. So there was always this kind of, how you balance that, you know, wanting to inform women who go out to work. But also, by then, there'd be families and husbands and children listening. So trying to make a programme that meets everybody, it's always been the hardest thing. And there was weekend women's hours, actually, for a very, very, very long time. It's just occasionally they get dropped off and then people forget and then they get reinvented. Looking back, you see, they've done it before, but it's always different. It's always done in a fresh way, which I think another reason why the programme survives so well, because it's new, but it's just, you know, the same things are important.
Sally, you were involved in something called Back to the Future, a project with the Department of Employment to try and help women returners. How did listeners respond to that?
They were hugely enthusiastic, because the project, which went on for a year, took Woman's Hour out right across the country, and it had workshops that were free to the listeners, and they could come and do workshops in leadership, in management, in getting back to work. And of course, people absolutely loved coming to our OBs, our outside broadcasts, and that was a year when we did many, and it was hugely popular.
And I have to say, because I was involved in that as well, and Jill, we did a big fiction project. I think it was 2004.
It was.
It was Women's Watershed, the novel. Was it the novel that changed your life, or the novel that you most remember?
No, it was the novel that most changed your life. And it was open to men as well, so it wasn't just women taking part in the exercise, but it was women's watershed fiction.
And how important were the listeners' contributions to that?
Well, they were vital, because by that time we had several message boards. Actually, we created a special message board for that project, and they contributed in their droves. And it sounds probably quite small now, but when we came to do the vote for the top 30 novels, I think it was just under 14,000 people voted. And now that probably wouldn't be that great a figure. But then it was one of the, you know, highest audience reactions that Radio 4 had had to a project.
And am I right in recalling it was Pride and Prejudice? That
Pride and Prejudice was the top one, absolutely. Yes, and the others were Jane Eyre and The Women's Room and Handmaid's Tale and To Kill a Mockingbird.
That is so funny, because I can remember when we serialised Pride and Prejudice, and one head of the department rang up because we'd had a discussion before the serial ended about Elizabeth Bennet and falling in love with Darcy. And he phoned up and told me off, and he said, "Now I know how it ended."
Yes, I once got told off about Anna Karenina.
You did.
I gave away the end and got into terrible trouble. I thought, doesn't everybody know that she, you know, I won't say, just in case there's anybody listening who hasn't finished it yet. But we have to be ever so careful. Now, still to come in today's celebratory programme, in advance of our 70th birthday in October, how has Women's Hour developed through the extraordinary changes that have happened for women during that period? With us throughout the programme are two former editors, Sally Feldman and Jill Burridge, and two historians, Juliet Gardner and Kate Murphy. And also, we need help from you. Of course. Will you please get in touch with us through the website if you have any recordings you made of the programme on your home equipment, especially from the 60s and 70s. Please don't send anything in the post just yet. We will ask you for it. Now, there was clearly a problem in 1948 with those talks on the menopause and worries about hot flushes and diseases of the ovaries at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, dumbing down the quality of broadcasting. But the programme never seems to have shied away from discussing health, divorce, abortion and homosexuality. In 1967, Olive Shapley issued a health warning about the next topic for discussion.
Well, Arthur and Sylvia, I think this next item is going to make some of you very angry, but these two young people have chosen deliberately to cohabit rather than marry, and they give their reasons. If their attitudes shock you or even just irritate you, as they well may, it's perhaps worth remembering that today there are other young people, particularly in the big cities, who hold this same point of view. Arthur wants to be an artist. He's done all kinds of fill-in jobs like navvying. Sylvia got a university place, but left after 2 terms to live with Arthur. In due course, Bridget was born. When I first knew them, Bridget was a few weeks old, living in a cardboard box in a room with no window panes. But in fairness to Sylvia, she was very well cared for indeed. I asked Sylvia first if she never felt that she wanted to get married.
Well, I do eventually, because I think it's sort of showing everybody publicly how you feel about each other. And not sort of, and I want everybody to know. That's why I wear a wedding ring, although I'm not. But there's not a desperate hurry, simply because I don't see any point in it. I mean, we've got everything we want. I mean, we didn't sort of rush to get married as soon as I found out I was expecting the baby.
When you say you've got everything you want, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, our relationship wouldn't be improved, I don't think, by marriage. In fact, Arthur might begin to feel he's being pressed too much, and he's not exactly free. I mean, now he's free, he can do exactly what he likes. And also there is the fact that if he wants to walk out, he can, whereas in marriage he's legally bound to me.
Well, we're living in a state of marriage all the time, and the fact of getting married will just be just a party, and that's all. There'd be just legal preparations, you know, for living together.
Do you feel that no one is going to suffer if you don't get married?
I think Bridget may eventually, because she'll always be legitimate, but then that's not so bad anymore. There are thousands of illegitimate children. But, well, I'd like her to know that we were sure enough of ourselves to get married, not necessarily for her sake, although it would be for her sake more than anything, I think, if we did at the moment. But I'd like her to be legitimate someday.
Sylvia and Arthur speaking to Olive Shapley about cohabitation in 1967. Shock. Horror. Juliet, how important has it been for women and men to hear these controversial subjects discussed?
I think it's extremely important because it gives a sort of voice to something, doesn't it? I mean, people might have had these feelings, they might have known about these things, but then to hear, I mean, there's an authority when it comes through, you know, the radio or the wireless, perhaps it was then. So I think it is very important, and also it's sort of air subject. I mean, that was such a reasoned argument for cohabitation. I mean, it's that, the idea of breaking down prejudices and things, and somehow it normalised things if you hear it talked about on the radio. So it's the same with discussions about abortion. Of course, abortion was illegal for a long time, as was homosexuality. But giving people the knowledge that other people had these sort of issues, these had these problems, had these feelings, seems to me one of the most valuable things something like a community communication can do.
Sally, Janet Quigley, the editor in the 1950s, spoke of the duty to bring hush-hush topics into the open. How much of a duty has it been?
I think throughout it has been a duty. It has been the most, well, what we heard from those 1970s listeners, that Woman's Hour had changed their life. And those were the sorts of letters and responses that I've always found most moving. Because you're hearing about somebody else's experience, you don't feel alone. And very often the most frequent letter was, I didn't know about it, and then I heard about it on Woman's Hour, and all that's changed is the it. So it might have been abortion, it might have been homosexuality, it might have been ME, it might have been breast cancer, but it's always that response that has been there all the way through and vitally important.
But Jill, how did Woman's Hour respond to the discomfort that some listeners would have felt about that growing taste for openness, particularly in the late 60s?
I think you would get reaction, yes, but there would always be a divide. There would be the divide between the people who said, thank goodness you put that voice on radio and how moving it was. And I think I felt an immense privilege that people felt that they could open up to you in that way. And of course, you got the criticism, which you had to be careful to try and take into account before you broadcast the item, so that the standards of taste and decency weren't breached overly.
But the programme's always been a magazine programme. How easily does, say, oh, postnatal depression, you know, something really serious, sit alongside Cook the Perfect?
Those gear changes are always tricky, but a breath, a pause.
It's always up to you, actually, Jenny.
Yes, I know. Do you remember the White Rhino?
I was about to mention the White Rhino.
Go on.
Well, actually, beyond the White Rhino was you were supposed to say, there's nothing worse than getting tomato ketchup on your white jacket. And I think that was straight after the killing of the White Rhino. But you fortunately said, I can't possibly say that's the worst thing. And you managed to avoid it. But what I do remember saying to the producers was, there is no topic that you can't cover. It's how you cover it. And occasionally one would get challenges. And there was somebody who said, well, I bet you wouldn't let me do an item about orgasm. And I said, well, go ahead and see if you can do it tastefully. And of course, she did.
When we look at health questions, and one of them, of course, has been breast cancer, that has come up over and over and over again over the years. But how did the way the programme tackled subjects like breast cancer change over the years as we began, I think, to help the listeners become more demanding patients?
That increased with almost deliberate campaigning by the time we got to the 1990s. And certainly for Woman's Hour's 50th anniversary, the concentration was on health. But I can remember us being very proud when we'd done items about cervical cancer and how that was treated. And we actually, I'm convinced it was Woman's Hour that changed what sounds tiny, but it wasn't. And that was that if a woman has had a cervical smear and is recalled, the letters never go out on a Friday, because it was so bad for them to have to worry all weekend. And that was the kind of thing we would point out. But I think the most significant changes were the number of women who were prepared increasingly to come on the programme and talk about their experiences alongside hugely authoritative medical experts. And it was that combination that maybe people made became more informed, became more demanding, sometimes became more angry. And I think that constant attention to women's health, and that in particular, has made a big difference to policy.
Julie, how much difference would you say it's made to policy that women have become more demanding of the NHS?
Oh, I would have thought it made a huge difference for policy, and things like, you know, trials and things like that, trials of drugs for, you know, screening, smears, this sort of thing. Because it's a huge programme of education to get people to have preventative health or early diagnosis. And I can't think of a better medium than the radio to do so. So I do think it's sort of made an enormous difference. And we talk about things. And also, I mean, the very fact that women, now we can talk about women as being sort of sexual beings. I mean, that's opened, you know, it's not just, you know, erectile dysfunction or something that is a problem. Women have sexual problems. Women have sexual needs. The fact that Woman's Hour talked about that opened up a huge area of, I'm sure, unhappiness, which has, you know, been now able to be counselled or helped in some way.
And of course, Woman's Hour has always been a forum for male health as well, because men are reluctant to go to the doctor, as we know, and it's often women listening to Woman's Hour who then said to their husbands, I've just heard that item and you need to go and see the GP.
Now, I'm often asked, why is it still called Woman's Hour? Isn't the name a bit old-fashioned? And my answer is, it has to keep the name to keep the men intrigued. They are, as we've said before, 42% of the audience, or perhaps I should say, you are 42% of the audience. As far back as 1983, a similar question was being asked, and Woman's Hour invited listeners to let the programme know what it ought to be doing in the future. Here, Sue McGregor was joined by Valerie Grove and Anne Karp. Sue asked Anne if there was such a thing as a woman's angle.
Yes, I think there is. I mean, what I don't think there is necessarily a biologically woman's angle. I don't think we're born into particular viewpoints. But there's no doubt about it that women's lives and men's lives in this kind of society, and certainly most Western societies, are very, very different. Women have different responsibilities. On the whole, women are responsible for childcare, domestic labour, housework. And a very high proportion of women in this society also go out and do paid work outside the home, either full-time or part-time. And they have a great problem juggling and reconciling those competing demands.
Valerie Grove, would you agree with that?
I think that's certainly very true, almost worryingly true. However, I do think that there is a woman's way of dealing with this, which is to get on with it in the most sensible way.
Sort of rising to the demands.
Rising
that are
to
made,
the demands,
made.
Yes.
I think so. We've got one of our listeners who responded in our letters column on the line now, I think. Jane Godfrey of Luton, are you there?
Hello.
Jane, hello. Am I allowed to say that you're 23 and that you have a young baby who's 3 months old? But that's a description that I have because of your letter. But how would you describe yourself additionally to that?
Well, I really think that I'm sort of a mother, a woman, a feminist and a housewife.
Right. A feminist, in that case, you would perhaps agree with some of the points Anne Karp was making. She said she would like a more feminist stance on the programme.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think that's what the programme ought to be all about, really.
What would you like more of on the programme, for instance?
I should like to hear sort of more items on childcare, also the development of babies and children, sort of at the preschool age. And you do have to plough through an awful lot of what you don't need to know in order to get to what you do need to know.
But as a feminist, it sounds as if you approve of our covering what are known as the traditional women's interests.
Yes, that's very true. I sort of believe in the art of housekeeping, which is what I do all week. And, you know, sort of like to hear about it.
Right. Valerie Grove.
Well, isn't it interesting that a feminist actually thinks of herself as a housekeeper and also as a bringer up of children? Of course, and this is right, because feminism doesn't preclude these things at all. I'm thinking about the 10 babies I know personally who will be born in 1983. None of the mothers actually are as young as Jane, none of them are under 28, and most of them are over 35, and most of them are first-time mothers, which is a whole new listenership area for you, of women who are of a certain age and have had outside interests and outside work for a long time and now are going into babies and actually know nothing about babies at all.
And Anne, would you like to comment on what Jane said? Because you're a feminist, but not, as far as I know, a mother.
No, I'm not. I agree very much with what she said. It makes me think of two points. The first one is that housework is very often devalued or invisible elsewhere in the media. You don't hear about it. It's the great productive output of this nation. We're all busily doing our housework and one never hears about it. The second is that on the matter of childcare, the kind of items I'd be interested in seeing are not the sort of items that necessarily make women feel guilty because this is what you should be doing and you're not doing it properly, but that address the reality of what it's like to bring up children, the joys and the difficulties, and address it in a very realistic way.
Valerie Grove, Anne Karp and Jane Godfrey speaking with Sue McGregor in 1983. Sally, how easy did you find it to define a woman's angle and what a programme like Woman's Hour should do?
Well, there was a sort of policy that emerged, which we called the Twin Peaks. And it was a double policy in that On the one hand, women's hour needed to cover things of particular interest to women and their experiences. And the other peak was to cover absolutely anything and everything, but from a woman's perspective. And so, quite unlike Norman Collins at the very beginning, we always went out of our way to ask any company, any organisation for a woman speaker. And that was the licence that the name of Women's Hour gave to us. And so it had what I think Anne Karp defined as a very female perspective, without in any way excluding anybody, whether they were people who were at home, people who were worried about feminism, people who were radical. The whole lot could be encompassed in the Twin Peaks.
But that criticism for being too feminist and not feminist enough, Jill, went on and on. How did you deal with that?
It still goes on and on, doesn't it? I think actually it's become more comfortable, really. There's a new generation of young feminists who are very vocal. I think maybe they're more tolerant than a previous generation of protagonists were, who felt the need to be slightly more aggressive, assertive about their feminism. But everybody, well, I say everybody, but I'm sure most people would support equal rights and the main principles of feminism. And I don't think that now that's such a difficult thing to meld together.
In the 90s, Sally, there was a move from 2 o'clock to the morning and a threat to the name and the focus of the programme. How did you hang on to it?
The controller of Radio 4 at the time, Michael Green, was worried about what he called the hammock, which was a dip after 9 o'clock, and after then you'd get Start the Week and those programmes, and then hardly any listeners until lunchtime. And he wanted to address that dip by putting in there a very popular programme, which was Woman's Hour. And he also wanted to increase the male listenership, and which he thought was very low. In fact, it was about 28%. You're doing jolly well, Jill, if it's 42 now. And so he thought that it would put off men if it was still called Woman's Hour. And so he wanted both to move Woman's Hour to the morning and lose the name. And I don't think that people working for the BBC now would have got away with half of what we got up to, because we basically staged a massive revolt and said, do what you want, put us where you want, you are the controller, you can schedule us when you want, but we cannot lose the name, because if we lost the name Woman's Hour, its ethos would go, this national treasure would go, we would no longer ever be able to ask for women speakers, look at things from a woman's point of view, and we won.
And there were Woman's Hour man badges, which were strategically placed at one stage in the
council
chamber.
Well, yes, we had these I'm a Woman's Hour man badges made for our male listeners as part of our campaign to encourage them and thank them. And at the time, there was a big party in the BBC council chamber. I think it was for the Archers. It was Shula getting married or something. And the BBC council chamber is festooned with very, very grave, solemn portraits of past director generals. And when the press arrived for this party, each of the grave director generals sported an I'm a Woman's Hour badge.
How important, Jill, has humour always been to the mix?
Well, I think it's essential, because as human beings and as listeners, it's just lovely, isn't it, to be able to hear something funny and to laugh about it. And actually, dear Michael Green, we invited him back for the 60th anniversary, do you remember? And we challenged him about, you know, he was the man who dared to move Woman's Hour from 2 o'clock in the afternoon to 10 o'clock in the morning. And he told this hilariously funny story about how he'd gone on holiday after the whole furore with his wife, and they were in this sort of parador in Spain, and there was one other English couple there, and in the evening they were sort of chatting away, and this woman kept saying to him, what do you do? So he said, oh, I work for the BBC. And what do you do? I work for radio. And then it had come out, and what do you do? I'm the controller of Radio 4. And this woman said, so you're the man who dared to move Woman's Hour.
He got to the stage where he couldn't go out anywhere, could he? He got into such terrible trouble. Kate, what would you say is recognisable now from that early idea of 1946 of what a Woman's Hour should be?
Well, it always was a mix of the kind of domestic work, equality issues, funny issues, personal issues, health issues. The listener was so important, and I think that's come through. I mean, I was amazed to find out that they had, back in the 50s, listeners, a whole week of listeners choosing the programmes, for example, something I know that's been picked up recently. Sally's talking about big projects, that they actually had a Women's Hour House at the Ideal Home Exhibition in 1957, all sorts of things. So they've had these big projects. But they've also had these very, very, very personal talks, these things that really have changed people, women's lives and men's lives the whole way through.
And Juliet, how accurately would you say the programme has reflected the gender quake? I mean, in 70 years, women's lives have changed immeasurably.
It's been absolutely, I think, a revolution. In many ways, for many people, perhaps it's been a quiet revolution, but it undoubtedly has been a revolution in women's lives. But on the other hand, things have persisted. I mean, economically, I mean, we still haven't got equal pay for women, and Women's Hour keep sort of, you know, talking about this. When we talk about divorce, for example, too, I mean, divorce legislation has changed, but the economics of divorce have not changed very much at all. So Women's Hour still, it seems to me, is carrying these threads forward, and they keep getting sort of, as it were, recoated with new concerns, or maybe old concerns, you know, rewoven. And I think that makes it, you know, that is tremendously important, because the other thing is that, in a way, separate spheres have been eroded up to a point. I'm sure if we look back to our own parents, they lived much more sort of separate lives in some ways. I mean, we now talk about parenting, don't we? And we talk much less about, I mean, talk about motherhood, and so we should, but we also sort of talk about parenting. We no longer think that women work for pin money. We think they're a prop to the household economy, and indeed to the national economy. So these things have changed in the big picture, but what women's are often does is to fill in a point de vue detail how these things are changing, how they've affected women's lives, and how they've got to go on. I mean, it's got an agenda for the future too.
Jill, would it be commissioned today?
I don't think it would be commissioned as Women's Hour. I can't envisage that. And I remember you and I once having a conversation about what would we call a programme if it wasn't called Women's Hour, that could have this same blend of anything and everything. But the other side of that is, it's a very successful programme with a huge following, and if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Do you think it would be commissioned today, Sam?
No, I'm afraid I do agree with Jill. But one of the things that has helped it survive, in a rather negative way, I suppose, apart from all the other very positive things, is that the radio airwaves have become increasingly crowded. There are so many programmes, many magazine programmes. Women's Hour kept its voice. You knew what you were going to listen to. You get programmes on the air these days where you're not quite sure why the items are in there. With Women's Hour, you always know. And that's how it's carved its identity. So although it's survived, there is no way, I don't think, that it could have been commissioned now. Nobody would have been able to envisage what a treasure it was born and it still is.
Sally Feldman, Jill Burridge, Juliet Gardner, Kate Murphy, thank you all very much for being with us for the start of these celebrations.